the Medical Journal of Australia, I'm Kate Swanell. Welcome to the second episode in our new podcast series, Voice of the GP. Today, I'm lucky enough to be speaking with Dr. Jill-Anne Farmer, a Brisbane-based GP, who just happens to be the former medical director of the United Nations. From the Ebola outbreaks of Central and West Africa, to Syria's chemical weapons fallout, to COVID-19's terrifying peak in New York, Dr. Farmer has been all over the world, managing the UN's responses to disease and warfare. Now she's back in Brisbane practicing as a GP again, doing something she says feeds her soul.
And if you are a person who is struggling to choose which specialty you love the most, if you are a person who really enjoys long-term relationships with people, if you are a person who enjoys mental agility of jumping from one thing to the next, and if you enjoy breadth, then general practice is a great profession for you.
Dr. Jill-Anne Farmer is my special guest today. So you've gone back to basics.
I have. I needed to feed my soul for a while. I felt really disconnected, and I was actually starting to think that I would have to relinquish my registration if I didn't return to clinical work for a while.
What made you feel disconnected?
It was really very weird, but like when I was working at the UN, every day my medical expertise was part of the job. But when I came to Queensland Health, the job that I was in was never actually designed as a clinical job. Even though they recruited for a clinical person, there were just always other medical people around who had more expertise. And so I just didn't really feel like I was making great use of my medical brain.
Are you enjoying it back in GP?
It's fed my soul because I've stepped in and out of clinical work several times throughout my career. And each time I leave, I miss it. And each time I return, I have these moments where I stop and think, this is amazing. Like people walk in and I'm a complete stranger and they just trust by virtue of the fact that I'm the doctor. So our profession still carries, with all of its challenges, there's just that amazing trust that people let you into their life and share their stuff with you. And I'm always blown away by that. I think also bizarrely, working outside clinical work has in some regards made me a better clinician. One of the bits of feedback that I get from my patients, and obviously, you know, it's not necessarily a statistically valid sample, but it's different to what I used to get, is that they tell me that I really listen to them. Yeah. That's a skill that I probably acquired and really refined and had to rely on in the UN because I was traveling in uncharted territory, knowing nothing. And that art of setting aside your preconceptions, really listening to what the person is saying, I think has made me a better clinician, although I don't claim to be any great expert. And I have to say, I have yet to encounter a consultation where a man walks in and says to me that no one's listening. And I do bring a feminist perspective to my interpretations. One can't work with Antonio Guterres and step away, not feminist. But I have really been struck by that, how often women walk in and say, nobody's listening to me and I've heard you listen. I've heard that you are a doctor who listens, and I have not had a man come to me. And I think that's something that we as a profession need to reflect on. And it might just be that the blokes don't complain about it, or if they do complain about it, they don't come and complain to me about it. But I'm curious about what lies beneath that.
So you started out as a regional GP.
Yeah, so I started my career as a bonded scholarship holder for Queensland
Health.
Back in the day when Queensland Health ran its own rural scholarship scheme. So I worked in a few jobs that they couldn't fill with volunteers.
Yes.
And whilst I didn't particularly like that at the time, it was really, really good to do and a very important part of my overall formation of my character. And I don't mean character as in, you know, character building. I mean the character of the kind of doctor I became.
Were you always interested in the UN?
Yes, yes.
Was that like a childhood dream?
Totally. Bizarrely. Wow. Really quite bizarrely, and not one that I ever thought would come true. And this is where it gets embarrassing. So I used to read Phantom comics.
Cool.
And Diana, the Phantom's wife, work at the UN. I used to read fandom comics and see Diana going in to work as a nurse at the UN, and they would even have little pictures of the secretariat. The Phantom would drop Diana off at the curb on First Avenue near 42nd Street, and she would walk in and be a nurse at the UN. So that was part of it. But I remember as well having a book. I had a book as a child that had a story about United Nations Day at school and all the kids
came. All the costumes and stuff.
Yeah, exactly. So yeah. I guess I'd always had a fascination with other cultures and other countries. What's really interesting was while I was in New York, I did this really geeky thing of going along to a Star Trek exhibit. I sat the aptitude test and I actually was not appointed as a medical officer. I was appointed as a communications officer.
Oh, that's interesting.
Because of my cultural curiosity.
Cool. So were you looking out for the job?
The story of how I got that job is fascinating.
Okay, tell me.
I went off and did an executive development course very generously sponsored by Queensland Health. One of the modules was about power. And while I was doing that, I realized that I had quite a lot of girly baggage about power. And I realized that I would need to sort of process that and come to terms with it if I was going to be able to progress in my career, because I discovered that I was very reluctant to exercise power. So I was thinking about where to go on that. And then one day somehow something blipped onto my screen, and it was a Harvard executive development course called Women and Power. And I thought, this looks like it's been made for me. So I toddled off. I used some of my professional development leave and took myself off to Harvard and did this course. While I was there, I met a woman who was working at the UN. I was actually a little underwhelmed by her. I now know that she was actually working in a very junior role, but I remembered there sitting there thinking, you don't actually seem that crash hot. And maybe I could successfully compete for a job at the UN. And then on the way home in the plane, when they're giving out the magazines, someone handed me a copy of The Economist. And in it, I discovered that that was where the UN advertised their jobs.
Cracking.
So I went home, I took out a subscription to The Economist, and the third edition that got delivered to my letterbox had the advertisement for the medical director job in it.
And you thought, why not?
I applied. I just wrote an application. People say to me all the time, how did you get that job? And the answer is, I applied. You don't get it if you don't ask. Look, my goal was to get an interview, and I thought that it would be really cool to get an interview from the UN, and I was expecting to get bruising but formative feedback. And then I got a job offer, and it was so funny because my husband, bless his little cotton socks, when I put the application, he's like, yes, dear. Yes, you applied for the job. And then I got an interview, and he's like, oh, that's interesting. And then I got a second interview, and he was starting to get nervous. And then the offer came, and he was very supportive and said, it's the UN, you can't say no.
So, did he go with you to New York?
He didn't. Originally, because of visa problems, he wasn't an Australian citizen. So he stayed and eventually got his Australian citizenship. But by that stage, we decided that I was traveling so much, it really wasn't worth his while to be in New York, because I would have dragged him over there to be abandoned. So we ran an intercontinental marriage for nearly seven and a half years. But we did have lots of really cool holidays.
You were 7 years in that job, and it covered some pretty humongous issues.
Yeah.
Ebola, Zika, Syria. were you in charge when the Syrian chemical weapons thing happened?
Yes, I was. Yeah. Wow. That was huge learning curve. I guess the context is that the UN had always stated that its personnel would not operate in a chemical weapons environment because they didn't have the infrastructure, training, or medical support to do so. But they shifted and adopted what they called the stay and deliver approach. So that rather than evacuating UN personnel at every sign of danger, the MO was stay and deliver. But there's also the reality that most people are unaware of, is that the majority of UN personnel in any location are locally recruited people. So the international staff like me in the actual field are the minority. And so when you're considering something like Syria, even if we got all the international staff out, there were still many thousands of locally recruited staff, and that introduced some interesting complexities to it all. I had to learn really fast about chemical weapons, about a chemical weapons chain of care, about, you know, the appropriate use of injectable antidote kits, about shelter in place, about hoods, about, you know, rescue chains, all of that stuff, which working as an Australian GP had really not prepared me for.
Well, no.
But one of the things that I learned relatively early in my career is to just ask for help. If the person you ask doesn't know how to help you, they will often know who will. So I used to make my own little rescue chains and climb my way along until I found the person who could help me with the right knowledge. And luckily, the Office for the Prevention of Chemical Warfare was at that time a specialised agency, not quite part of the UN, but definitely affiliated with us. So I had access to some really good advisors.
I'm chatting today with Dr. Jill Ann Farmer, former Medical Director of the United Nations and now back as a practising GP in Brisbane. This podcast accompanies an article in Insight Plus, our weekly online news magazine. You'll find the full link in the show notes to this podcast. If you're enjoying this podcast, you can see our entire back catalogue at mja.com.au/podcasts, where they are all free to access. To subscribe to upcoming episodes, go to your favourite podcast platform and search for Medical Journal of Australia. Back to our chat. How important is it to surround yourself with people who know more than you?
Oh, absolutely critical. And I, you know, one of the things that I, where I see leaders fail is when they can't surrender the desire to be visibly the cleverest person in the room. You do so much better when you surround yourself with people who know more about their stuff than you do.
Yeah.
And when you pull them forward when their expertise is needed. In the job that I had at the UN, I couldn't work any other way. And when I came back to Queensland, because I'd been out of Australia for so long, I couldn't work any other way. You have to rely on the clever people. And I like to try and recruit people who are smarter than me.
What was it like in New York at the peak of the COVID experience?
It was terrifying. It was really terrifying.
Who was in charge? Was it the city in charge?
Yeah, that's right. So, well, it was an interesting mixture. So, yes, in the United States, cities operate much of the infrastructure that we would normally associate with our states. Cities run the public health response. The cities run the police. The cities run a lot of the disaster management. And so the city had an incredibly robust public health response, which was overwhelmed very fast. And the city also had a commissioner who was appointed directly for liaison with the UN, and she and I formed, we'd never met before, it all went to hell and back, but we worked really closely together because the city had the intel. They also had the responsibility. There's a concept in diplomacy called the host country and the host city. The host city, New York, had particular responsibilities towards the diplomatic community. As the medical director of the UN, I had the ability to help them discharge those responsibilities and to navigate some of the diplomatic complexities, because the de Blasio administration in New York had equity and access as a really key plank of their platform. And the UN also, you know, a big advocate for health equity. None of us wanted to set up a system where the diplomats and UN staff would have preferential access to testing or treatment. We were in there with the rest of New York, unsure if we would get access to a ventilator if we needed it, if we would even, and for quite some time, we were even unable to access testing. So we were diagnosing people based on clinical symptoms alone. And it was really very scary because the paramedics were turning up and they were triaging in on site and making decisions. They're basically black tagging people in their homes and then just leaving to go to the next person who might be salvageable. It was a pretty torrid time. I left just as it was accelerating, because when Australia put out its what I call the homing beacon, when DFAT said, come home now or be prepared to ride the pandemic out where you are, I took that very seriously. A lot of people didn't. They didn't think they really meant it. I had accepted the job in Queensland already, and my planned date for return was May. Pandemic broke and the SG asked me if I would stay to see out the pandemic. I don't think he or any of the people who'd not studied pandemic history understood that this was going to be
years.
So I did extend. Queensland Health were very gracious and allowed me to stay for some extra time. But then Virgin grounded, Qantas grounded, and the UN agreed to just send me home on the last available flight, which was an interesting experience in itself, because I had just said to them, yes, I'll extend, but I have to do it from Australia. Yep. And they said, yep, okay, we'll just get you on the last available flight. And they rang me and said, it's in 16 hours. So I had 16 hours to get to a plane and get home. So I came home and I just set up camp in, luckily I have a home office, and I would log on every night at 11 p.m. and work through the night to be fully synchronized with New York. And I did that for, I think, 3.5 months. 3.5 months of night shift. It was interesting. I was relieved when it finally was over, even though I was very sad. And I felt terrible. I really did have terrible survivor guilt for a while that I was out and all of my friends were there and at risk. It was really, really hard to leave them.
So you're back into GP now. When you look at it compared with 20 years ago, say, what are the concerns you might have about general practice right now in Australia?
Oh, I've got a lot of concerns about general practice right now. There are some things that are great, but there are some things that are really hard. I think the one that everybody talks about is the financial sustainability. I think that remains a big issue. The pay gap between general practice specialists and other specialists is just indefensible when one considers the complexity and pace of general practice work. And I think that the biggest concern I have is the split between federal and state funding of the health mechanisms and the space that allows for finger pointing and blame, with GPs kind of trying to bridge the gap. At least that's my analysis of it. I'm really pleased that there's, that the Queensland government, and I know the other state governments, have been advocating for revisions to the health funding model. And I think there's a lot of work to be done to try and unify that, to find a way that disincentivizes the states from transferring unpaid work into general practice, because that does happen. And I'm not criticizing, because it's simply a fact, and they are short. They're short-staffed and underfunded themselves and trying to make things stretch. The complexity of the system and the disrespect for general practice is pretty aggravating. And I think that there's been that progressive erosion of a sense that general practitioners are a valuable part of the healthcare team. But every now and then I'm delightfully surprised. Like, I got a beautiful phone call from a surgical registrar in the Northern Territory a couple of weeks ago who was transferring a patient back to my care in Queensland, and she bothered to pick the phone up and have a real conversation with me.
Brilliant.
And it was wonderful, but that actually shouldn't be remarkable. No. But it is. General practice is now very dependent, or has been very dependent, on IMGs. And without them, our system would completely buckle. But I'm not sure that we yet treat them as valued members of the profession. I think that and Australian society continues to hold some very racist stereotypes about our international colleagues. And that's something I struggle with when my patients are just overtly racist about colleagues. I really struggle with that. And, I know that I've been incredibly privileged, and I returned to general practice and within days my books were full, not because I'm the bestest, shiniest GP around, but because I happen to be a white Australian-trained female doctor. That gives me a certain image with patients that may well not be backed up if you were to examine, standards of clinical practice.
If you had a room full of medical students in front of you, how would you persuade them to go into general practice, given the current circumstances?
Well, I guess the question would be, would I persuade them? How would I persuade them, but would I persuade them? Yeah. And I probably wouldn't, because that's not my place. What I would advocate for is that people follow their heart and their aptitudes. And if you are a person who is struggling to choose which specialty you love the most, if you are a person who really enjoys long-term relationships with people, if you are a person who enjoys mental agility of jumping from one thing to the next, and if you enjoy breadth, then general practice is a great profession for you. There comes a point where people have to make a decision about, do they wish to choose another specialty because they might be richer and more respected, but perhaps less fulfilled? Or do they choose a profession that might feed those particular elements of their soul? I don't think general practice is for everyone. No. And I think that you have to make that choice based on what general practice offers as a career.
So what's next?
I have no idea. I'm very good at taking things a step, you know, a day at a time. That was definitely something, you know, like I became accustomed to traveling and not knowing what was going to happen when I got to the other end. You just have to kind of trust the universe.
Because you were essentially, you were the Surgeon General for all the UN peacekeeping troops, weren't you?
That's right.
So did you have to go to all these trouble spots? Like, did you end up in the middle of an Ebola outbreak?
I did. Travelled to some really interesting places in my time.
Yeah.
Two of the most memorable, one was Mogadishu. One was Sana'a in Yemen. And I was supposed to head up to Aden as well, but the shelling was too intense and we just had to stay in Sana'a. So I did try as much as, you know, like there's not an unlimited amount of money for travelling. And so, you know, when I did travel, it needed to be meaningful and for a purpose. So I went into Sana'a to assess, you know, how well the local health infrastructure was holding together under bombardment and what additional support we needed to put in. In Mogadishu, I went in to try and troubleshoot some issues that we were having with our own UN-operated facility, but also to be that ceremonial presence of acknowledging the amazing work that was being done by local Somali practitioners to look after UN personnel. So there were often reasons. I was never a tourist, but always, you know, like Mogadishu was really a very interesting experience because I was riding around in a ballistic rated vehicle with a helmet on and a flak jacket, driving through streets where children were kicking soccer balls. It just felt really dissonant and weird.
Any regrets of doing it?
Oh, not at all. It was a big gamble, you know, like a certain degree of chutzpah to just go, yeah, I reckon I can do that. And a lot of luck to get the job because the succession plan had failed. They had a very shallow succession pool. And basically everybody retired at once, and so it was a genuine, you know, no succession vacancy into a very senior role at the UN, and that doesn't happen very often.
Thank you.
I
really appreciate your time. I think it's a fascinating career you've had so far. It's going to be interesting to see what happens next.
Who knows? But for now, I'm really enjoying looking after real people in general practice, and that I don't lose that connection with clinical work.
My thanks to my special guest today. Don't forget that all our podcasts are open access and available at www.mja.com.au/podcasts. Or you can subscribe to our feed at iTunes. My name's Kate Swanell, and we'll see you next time.